Hey there, friends and countrymen. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 259. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com, type in This Show Is So Gay, and click follow. And of course, go to the Facebook, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed show for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Diane Anderson Minshall is an editor, a journalist, an author, an interviewer, and so much more. She is an editor-at-large over at The Advocate and the editor-in-chief of HIV Plus magazine. She was co-founder and editor of both Girlfriends and Alice magazines in the 1990s, and she was the longtime editor-in-chief of Curve magazine. Her work has appeared in so many other magazines, newspapers, anthologies. She's been on radio and television. She was named one of Power Up's 10 Powerful Gay Women in showbiz. She was a GLAAD Media Award winner. She was a finalist for the Exceptional Women in Publishing's Woman of the Year Award and the recipient of an Excellence in Journalism Award in Northern California. Last year, she was honored by LA Pride with the Osborne Michaels Media Award, which honors those who disseminate information to the public for the betterment of the LGBT community in order to raise awareness and fight for equality. Diane co-edited the anthology of LGBT youth writing called Becoming: Young Ideas on Gender, Race, and Sexuality, and she writes the Blind Eye Mystery series with her husband, Jacob. Diane, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh my God, you have me blushing over here. Are you dating my publicist or what?
I left so much out.
And I have a new book coming out May 12th.
Oh my gosh.
It's actually our first memoir.
I feel like I don't do enough. And that's just reading your bio.
Oh, I don't get enough sleep. So, trust me. It's a trade-off.
Well, we'll talk about that. So much to discuss. Are you ready?
Yeah, absolutely. Bring it on.
I am a little confused. Well, honestly, I'm a little confused how you balance these things. How do you balance working at The Advocate and HIV Plus magazine? They're such colossal roles, and you do them both so well.
Oh, thank you. Well, at The Advocate, my role at the, when I originally came on to Hear Media 3 years ago, I was an executive editor at The Advocate. And I remember when I did my, my interview with then editor-in-chief Matt Breen to do the hiring, and he said, midway through, towards the end of the interview, he said, oh, I forgot to tell you, the executive editor, generally serves also as editor-in-chief of HIV Plus.
Oh.
And it was like very casually mentioned, and I think that, I don't want to say HIV Plus had been an afterthought. I just think it was something that folks had definitely had to, square around their other job duties at the Advocate Group. Because for us, our group includes Advocate Magazine and Gay.net, OutTraveler, SheWire.com, and HIV Plus. So I think that, everybody, all the folks who worked on it at the time had been sort of cobbling together, scraps of time to work on it. And so, for me, that actually changed, and we've been kind of retooling the magazine a little bit to make it more, I think, user-friendly, less newsy, less of an outgrowth of the Advocate's mm-hmm. news brand, and more of a service magazine for people with HIV that we think it is today. So, and so for the last 9 months, I've just taken over as I've been serving as editor-in-chief of HIV Plus, but I've also taken over HIVplusmag.com, the website, and really turned that into 90% of my time here. And then the other 10%, I serve as editor-at-large at The Advocate. So my duties at The Advocate, I no longer am responsible for the top-line editing or choosing articles, that kind of stuff. So they let me get to do what I want to do with The Advocate and write a semi-weekly column.
Well, let's go back a spell. I mean, what a storied career already in publishing. Did you work for the high school newspaper? I feel you were editor-in-chief.
I did.
I was kidding, and you totally were.
No, I totally were. In fact, I was very, very proud because I started my sophomore year, and all the upperclassmen were so mean to me. I was completely intimidated. But I was also, like, you know, just, like, this crazy, weird. I loved writing, and I wanted to write for, you know, I wanted to write for our hometown newspaper. I grew up in a small hometown in called Payette, Idaho. It's about 60 minutes from Boise, Idaho.
Okay.
And it was about 4,000 people in our town, and we had a weekly newspaper, and I remember going down there and just seeing the guys working on the printing press and the lone editor running the office, and I was so enamored, and I just kind of hung around and pestered them so long, I was like 13 at the time, that they let me hang around, and eventually, you know, I do things like clean the toilets and stuff, anything to hang around, and then eventually they let me start writing for the newspaper, so I write like a school column on what was happening with the schools in the system, and eventually got to start covering like city council meetings and stuff. And then as soon as I was old enough, yeah, I started my high school newspaper. And then when I was a junior in high school, this is so preppy and dorky, but I became the first junior to become editor-in-chief of the newspaper, which is like this big deal because as editor-in-chief, you like do some of the, you sort of like a guest teach some of the classes.
Yeah.
So I got to teach seniors, and I just remember thinking I was like all that, like this was it, you know, I had arrived.
I feel there was an expose in some, there somewhere. Somewhere you got hauled in front of the principal because you wrote that piece that got in trouble.
Gosh, I don't know. I do remember I did get my first time I got sent to the principal's office, I had written an article, or sorry, I'd written a speech, and I was giving it, and it was actually on it was something about cunnilingus.
Okay.
It was basically like on cunnilingus. I'd never performed it at the time, but I think I just like saying it and making the teacher shocked. So, and I remember the teacher yelling from the class room, stop right there, stop, stop. And the classes, you know, the students were urging me to go on. And so I kept reading, and it eventually ended with me with a pink slip in the principal's office. So,
but all in the defense of journalistic integrity.
Oh, exactly, because you know how important that is.
I almost sense some sarcasm there, Diane.
Oh, no. I think integrity is wonderful. I'm not really sure how cunnilingus fits in. So.
I love that in 6-plus years of the show, I have to go back now and look at the rules, whether I have to bleep that out or not. I have no idea.
Oh, no.
We'll find out.
Oh, no.
We'll find out
right.
Together. So tell everyone, I mean, Girlfriends Magazine and Alice Magazines, what does it even mean to co-found a magazine?
Oh, well, you know, Girlfriends was amazing. It was my first, and it was bred out of, at the time, I remember about a year before I had moved out from New Orleans, and my husband, who at that time was still my wife,
mm-hmm.
And I had been in New Orleans just a couple of months this time. We'd gone back to New Orleans, and I got a call from Honor Backs magazine, and I'd been trying to get a job there for, you know, a couple of years. I was very young. I think we were like 21, 22.
Okay.
But once I left, like, you know, mainstream publishing and moved to LGBT publishing, I saw how few jobs there were in it. And so this was like a national magazine, and it was for women, and it was really raising some hackles and stuff. So I took a job out there, and over the next year was at On Our Backs, and just this really amazing creative community of mostly queer women in the San Francisco Bay Area. But it was also, you know, typical of an indie publishing firm that was founded by women who had been girlfriends at one point but no longer were. They weren't even both lesbian at the time. So somebody had, you know, no longer identified as queer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it was always bleeding money. And so it come payday, they would take volunteers, like who could wait to get their paycheck, stuff like that. And I remember we would get our paychecks, and then there was a Bank of America right across the street. We would literally, like, flood out of there and run to the bank to try to cash our paychecks before they went bad.
Right.
You know? So it was that kind of environment, a lot of, like, you know, drama and conflict and stuff. And when the art director had gotten kicked out over a conflict with the publisher, three of us walked out at the time. It was myself and my editor-in-chief at the time, Heather Finley, and then Jacob, who at the time was Susie,
mm-hmm.
and who worked in the, you know, circulation department. And so basically, and then our art director. Bonnie Simon. And basically, the four of us sat around and formulated what it would take to start a magazine and where we would get the money and what we would do with it, and decided to do it. And a few months later, we were officially working on a new magazine.
Wow.
And that became Girlfriends.
It sounds like a lot of work.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
In those days, at first we didn't have an office, and so we would have, we would run everything out of our homes, and we were all so poorly paid, and Jake and I, we didn't have any, money to fall back on,
right,
the way some of the other folks did. And so I remember we were living in a trailer out in a horse ranch, like an hour from San Francisco, because it was like the cheapest thing we could find. It was $300, and it was like 16 feet, long, but we would have all the magazines shipped there.
Yeah.
So we'd have like boxes and boxes and boxes of magazines, just like filling the whole thing. And we would just work. There were many nights where we would just work, through the night in order to get things done on the budget on time. But if you look back at those old issues, it's amazing because they look like they could hold up against, many mainstream magazines.
Totally.
Which
totally.
We were very thrilled with. We had, like, Elle came out and spent the day with us. Somebody from Playboy came out and spent the day and profiled us. So we had a lot of, like, nice attention at the time.
How was it then making the transition? I know there were many projects in between, but making the transition to an already established magazine like Curve?
Yeah, it was really interesting, especially because for the longest time, Curve and Girlfriends were competitors.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was like, I was at, I left Girlfriends at the end of 1988, so say 99, and I, eventually sold my shares. I had a minority stake in it, and I sold my shares of the company back to Heather Finley, the only person still remaining with the organization, and used that money to start Alice, and Alice was much more short-lived. I think it was like the following year that I got a call. I started freelancing. I think that's what it was. I started freelancing for Curve, and then I got a call asking if I wanted to come and sub in for their editor at the time, who was going out on maternity leave. And so I went, and I was suddenly the direct competitor of, the magazine I started, which had been my baby for the longest time. And so it was really weird, but I think, since there was some hostility between myself and Heather, I think that it worked to my advantage.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I could just channel all of that energy into being a really good competitor and stuff. And it was an interesting thing because at Curve, definitely there was a sensibility among the readership and among the women who ran the magazine, our publisher, Frances Stevens, just wonderful, wonderful person in terms of the attitude she puts out there. So she's very, she can be competitive, but she was very much like, we're the good girls, we're the nice girls,
yeah.
So we don't bash the competition, we don't undercut anybody, we just, like, we win on our own merits, that kind of thing. So it was really nice to have that kind of ethos around, and I stepped really easily into that role. And when it was time to leave it, I left almost a decade later, basically. And the reason I left was because the magazine was being sold to an Australian company, and Frances was moving on, and much as staff was being laid off, and so that was a good point for me to leave.
Do you ever, not that anyone's going to hear this, but do you ever look at Curve magazine and think, yeah, I probably wouldn't have done that?
Yeah, of course. I think the editor, I think Marin knows that. I think Marin Johns is a very smart editor-in-chief, and her number two, Rachel Chateau, is one of my protégés, and I think she's brilliant. But of course, anybody who looks back is going to think, oh, God, why did they do that? I would have never done that. They shouldn't have done that. I'm sure everybody does that when they leave.
Well, I was so excited to have you on the show because I've been engaging in this topic for the past couple months, and I feel like you have the answer, no pressure. You referenced LGBT media, and certainly we've had the editors-in-chief of Out and The Advocate and the Huffington Post Gay Voices section on the show, and just trying to kind of wrap our minds around who gets to be a journalist these days. With kind of our social media accessibility, and I won't name any of the sites, but the ones where you can just throw something up in 2 seconds, who gets to have a voice out there, and how do you wrap your mind around all of this?
It's a tough one because, you know, I'm old guard. I'm so old school that I, you know, if you came into this profession originally thinking of yourself as a blogger, then I'm like, I have a tendency to be like, oh, okay, well, you're a blogger, not a journalist.
Right.
But I know that that's not really what's happening industry-wide. There's a lot of people blogging who are actually fine journalists, who are quite fine journalists and are doing some really interesting work. And then there are, you know, some folks out there who are, again, they're sort of the death of journalism,
right,
basically, the Upworthies of the world. I think it's a really tough call because I think that we can't really police who gets to call themselves a journalist, but I do think that there's a certain level of credibility that can be missing if somebody doesn't have, you know, sort of a breadth of knowledge.
Totally.
But I'm hoping that readers, after a while, can sort of suss. I don't know, actually. I was going to say I hope readers can suss between what's clickbait and what's real, but I actually don't think they can. If you look at, like, Facebook and you watch people comment, and you'll see people put inaccurate information all the time, and then everybody else starts jumping in and agreeing, or, they've just put in, you know, sometimes crazy stuff, and you'll see people back them up. And for me, for HIV Plus is where it's really dangerous, because sometimes they will put stuff that is actually just downright dangerous medically.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they will, and people will believe that they are experts, or that they, you know, that they have the same kind of credibility that somebody who actually has knowledge in the field does.
By the way, you said the phrase that I have to tell you, and I've been doing this for a long time. I had never heard of the phrase clickbait before a few weeks ago.
Oh, really?
I don't know where I've been. So just for people who don't know what it is, how would you define it for everyone?
Upworthy is a really good example of clickbait. But basically clickbait is, you know, sort of a headline that's meant to get you to click on it, and it doesn't necessarily have a lot of substance to do with it. And sometimes it can actually be, you know, quite disingenuous to the actual substance of the article. But a lot of times, you know, this is one of those things where Facebook just changed its algorithm so that if you are posting headlines on there, if you're just posting stuff that's clickbait, then it's less favorable to you now than it was just 3 weeks ago to post those kind of headlines. So supposedly they're saying they want people only to post headlines of articles that are substantive, that you can learn something from, or things that are about your favorite sporting team or something like that, but not, you know, here's a video of a kitten in a well.
Right. Right.
So,
well,
right?
I encourage people. I became obsessed with this a few weeks ago with all the drama around the new Vox site, and I just was thinking to myself, yeah, this is why I do radio. It makes it easier. So I did a little bit of a Diane immersion into some of your past articles, and in particular your op-eds, and you've posed some questions that I would like to pose back to you. Are you ready?
Okay.
So
sure.
I have three different ones that, and some of these, gosh, just came up again in the news this week. First, an easy one for you, Diane. As per your title, is your attraction to trans people a fetish?
It is not a fetish. I think everybody is attracted to, you know, we all have attractions. And I think the worst thing that we can do is hide what our attractions. And, of course, you know, gay people in particular, LGBT people overall, have been kind of arguing this point all our lives, that we can't hide our attractions, we can't control our attractions, and so we should be open about them. I think what happens is when you have attractions to trans people, that there has been in the past, you know, for trans women in particular, there's been the pornography treatment of them so much and so very, you know, marginalized, and the language used is very fetishy, and it is a fetish in a pornographic sense that way. And then, you know, we're starting to hear from more trans men who are, you know, they're having these awkward conversations with women who are attracted to them because they're trans. And so I think that the people who are transgender are always on the guard for are sensitive to this issue, basically, and that's definitely warranted. But my point is that you can be attracted to trans people in part because of their transness, and it's not a fetish. It's actually just part of a normal, healthy attraction.
Yeah.
There are some elements to being to having been raised in a gender that you were assigned at birth, even though it's not your gender, that brings something different and unique to your experience and informs your character.
By the way, in that piece, you have a section on the words shemale, which, my gosh, mm-hmm. that's in the news right now with RuPaul's Drag mm-hmm. Race.
Yeah, right. And that's one of those things where it's a term of pornography, and which is why it shouldn't be showing up on RuPaul. You know, we'd like to change it in pornography as well.
Yeah, totally.
But it's so steeped in it. Yeah, it's interesting because I've talked with a number of women who do sex work actually, and you know, mostly like videos and photos and posing and or actual adult films and stuff like that. And a lot of them, you know, are trans women. A lot of them actually use the word in relation to themselves in their like marketing materials because they feel like if they didn't, they would lose their audience. But they feel really conflicted about it because they know that it's sort of a degrading term and not an appropriate one to be using.
There you go. There you go. So folks should check out that piece. And then I have to tell you, oh my gosh, I read this so many times because I love this piece. I ask you the question, do LGBT pride marches still matter?
I think my argument was that they do. But I think that there's something that we miss in when we're in large urban metros where we can get very jaded. We can, you know, pride is a big party. You see a lot of people out there. You know, we're half naked, we're dancing, we're imbibing, whatever that means
right.
for different people. And you can be very jaded because it seems kind of commercial and that kind of stuff. But when you go to, you know, different towns, it's kind of amazing, like, what these celebrations mean. I still remember, you know, I actually met my husband actually at Idaho's second Pride celebration, and it was before there was a festival. It was just a march, and we met like on the steps of the Idaho State Capitol. But I remember on that thing, there were, you know, plenty of people that came in drag because it was unsafe for them to be seen in public as a gay person, but they wanted to be there.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, that's a state where you could still be fired for being gay. So, of course, that existed. And I remember we passed a lot of religious people with signs, you know, saying negative things along the route. And there were a lot of people. I was very young, like I said. I think we were 21 or 22. And so we were very young and stupid and confrontational. But there were a lot of older people there with a lot on the line. And I remember they were quite fearful to be there. But they're pushing through to do it. And I remember we had rounded one curve. It was a very small parade, but we had rounded one curve, and there was this woman out there who looked like she was a little frail thing. She looked like she was maybe 80 years old, and she had a sign that said something like God loves you, you know, like it was a welcome one. It wasn't like a protest sign. It was like an embracing one. And I remember it being so amazing, just seeing that one person. And it was so amazing for the people around me who were just, you know, couldn't stop hooting and hollering at her and stuff. And you see that when you go to Pride Parades, even big cities, you know, which is the one that gets all the attention. It'll be like when, it'll be great when all the shirtless, you know, hairless boys go by on their thing. And we'll all hoot and holler. The boys will hoot and holler, and the girls will do the same at the girly ones. But but when you actually see, like, the pay flag contingent go through, and you have all the, like, moms and dads with their signs about loving their queer kids, everybody is, like, on their feet, like, clapping and dancing and cheering for them. And that's like emblematic of what pride can be. It kind of reminds you of, you know, of your humanity, and it reminds you of what is, you know, the embrace that you can get from other people out there. And when you live in Tuscaloosa or Moab or, you know, any of the tiny towns in between who are not necessarily so tiny because, you know, you've got four major urban metros in the country and then everything else is a town. So.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, when you live in those places, it's significant and it really is meaningful.
And you got to be a Pride Grand Marshal in so many different festivals.
I know. It was really, really lovely. I mean, doing Idaho was amazing because it was not too long ago, and it was and, you know, it was going home after that, and it was a much bigger parade, and there was a festival, but I had a few people like from my high school who were like there before me, you know, come up to me and thank me for being there, and also were like, I was, you know, I had a girl who was like, I was kicked out of school in 1976, and I'm sure it was because I was lesbian, and I was like, You know, I had a graduating class of like 80 people. So, and we did have like five people who turned out to be gay afterwards, but, or bisexual. But you know, we were a really small school. And so just hearing from other people that came before us or after us was just like amazing. And so all these, but you know, all these pride, these places are all so unique and they're all so different and, just, you know, just really different.
That's a great piece.
And then writing in LA Pride last year was, again, another one where I can remember, you know, going to, I think it, Long Beach Pride was my very first Pride, and then LA Pride was my second Pride, and I went to them within weeks of each other in, whatever, it was 1989 or something like that. So, you know, being able to, like, come back around 25 years later or whatever it is.
We like full circles.
I'm a journalist, so my math is bad. But, yeah.
No, we like full circles. We like full circles.
Right? Well, they make you feel like, oh, this meant something. This was worthwhile.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. All right, some random ephemera that we have to cover. Tell everyone, if they don't know, who is Bang Bang Betty?
Oh, you are funny, you dodgy one. So Bang Bang Betty is actually my burlesque name. And I haven't been dancing the last couple years, but I danced for several years when I lived in Portland, Oregon, and San Francisco. And I had a troupe. We were B6 was what we were colloquially called, but it was Bang Bang Betty's Big Beautiful Bombshells.
Love it.
And we were, I mean, it was an amazing troupe of we were all queer. Everybody was queer. Everybody was plus size. And it was really about loving your body and loving to dance and performing for a crowd. And we did a lot of performances with drag performers and fundraisers for, you know, HIV and AIDS charities. And you know, it's just fun. I wish I had enough time to do it now, but darn, all these books I got to write.
I knew nothing about burlesque until I moved to Cleveland last summer. And
oh, really?
My gosh, it's quite hopping here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's really had a resurgence in the last 5 years. And a lot of that resurgence has actually been from queer women. So that's been really interesting. You go to all these cities and there's a big, you know, it's kind of like gone hand in hand with roller derby. So, you know, if you're tough enough for roller derby, you do that. And if you're, you know, if you're a lovely femme like me, you do the burlesque because it's a lot easier to take your clothes off than it is to get bonked on the head.
I bet. Well, HIV Plus magazine this May and June celebrating its 100th issue. That's kind of exciting.
It is. It really is.
Tell everyone who's going to be on the cover and what's happening there.
Okay. Mondo Guerrera is on the cover, and he's obviously the guy who came out on Project Runway and Under the Gun, and he's a huge celebrity at
Love
this
him.
Point. It's nice because, you know, we've had him on the cover before, but it was nice to kind of catch up with him at this point because what I love about Mondo is – like Jack McEnrath, who also came out on after Project Runway,
yeah.
For him, Mondo came out on air, is, you know, he has turned being positive into, you know, a form of activism, and he's been, you know, both of those guys have been involved with campaigns. They were both involved with the iDesign campaign with Merck last year and stuff. But Mondo in particular has really been able to show that that being a role model doesn't mean being perfect.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's still, if you watch him on TV, I mean, he can be a lovely little drama queen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the Lindsay Lohan sense, not the Alec Baldwin toxic little queen sense.
Right.
So, and you know, so I know that, like, when we posted, you know, some of the initial outtakes from the article, you know, the commenters were like, well, I really didn't like what he did in episode 16, or he really showed his stripes in blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, well, yeah, he's a normal human being. He's a young person, and he's an artist,
yeah.
Right? You know, so a lot of those are crazy making characteristics to begin with, but he's great because he's, you know, he's a great role model, and he's, you know, what was lovely about him is he was closeted about being positive for a decade and came out on national TV, and I think that sort of shows you, and he's continued to have a great career afterwards. He's gained pretty much widespread fame. He's stayed an activist, and he's in love, so he talks about his boyfriend, which is always really nice for people with HIV to hear other people talking about their healthy, good relationships,
yeah.
You know? And I think that one of the things about him, too, is, you know, being closeted for so long about being positive and then coming out and feeling that weight lifted off you, it kind of reminds you that as much as we talk about how HIV is like diabetes in that it's a manageable chronic condition, sure, they can both kill you if they're not managed properly, but they are just chronic manageable conditions, you know? And as much as we talk about that, there's still a real lack of education about what it means to be positive and what it means to have friends and lovers who are HIV positive. And so having him come out but taking so long, it kind of reminds you of the sort of real fear that there is of rejection, of stigma, the fear of even knowing sometimes, and the fear of coming out and you know, the fear of the unknown that comes with an HIV diagnosis. So I like that all of that is that he's just a real person. You know, next
totally.
Issue we have a very big A-list celebrity on the cover. I can't say who because we are under embargo right now, but it's somebody huge and he will attract a lot of traffic for what he brings to it. But in this particular case, Mondo is a real person that a lot of real people relate to. And anytime we can help somebody on the cover who's HIV positive themselves, it just helps remind our readers, you know, that they're not alone in this.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally. Well, last but not least, Queerly Beloved, coming out in just a few.
It is, May 12th.
For folks who haven't heard about it, I mean, you mentioned it briefly, what are we to expect as we snatch this up?
Okay, well, so it's Queerly Beloved, a love story across gender, and it's a nonfiction memoir that I wrote with my husband, Jacob. He's a transgender journalist, and I identify as queer. Some days I say lesbian-identified bisexual or bisexual-identified lesbian, but generally both of us just say queer because it's so much easier.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is really a kind of the concept, like imagine after 15 years together, the woman you love turns to you and says, I think I'm really a man, and what do you do? Because for us, it's not a hypothetical question, it's really what happened, and now we've been together 23 years total now, so we obviously remained together after he came out as a dude. We survived a gender transition, and we kind of delve into our own relationship and sort of, you know, having a relationship that sort of flies in the face of expectations and kind of, we hope, raises questions about, well, we hear from readers all the time, it raises questions about the nature of identity and love and sexual orientation.
Now, I do not want to raise any type of marital discord with this question, but how was it to write together?
You know what? This is our fourth book writing together.
Yeah.
We are like a little machine sometimes, actually. With our novels, it's actually easy because we have this agreement that, you know, we'll just take turns writing. So he'll write during the day, I'll write at night, and, you know, kind of a 24-hour factory position there. And so we have an agreement that whoever has the book at any given time can take it wherever they want it to go, right? And
right.
So that makes it easy, except that the next day you have to explain that the person they thought was a beautiful blonde is actually a stubby brunette. But, you know, either way, we can do whatever. With the Queerly Beloved, it was really difficult. What was difficult about it is we didn't write together. We each wrote our own sections, and then we revealed them towards the end, and then each went in and did some responses to the other sections. So there's some parts of the book that, you know, there's a couple things in the book that both of us wrote that the other person didn't really know ahead of time. And so, you know, we're finding out not too long before the reader finds out. So that's really interesting.
So exciting. All right. So to recap, folks, first, you need to go to HIVplusmag.com because there are some great things happening over at HIV Plus. And I love that you guys really do cover the gamut. This is one of those publications that's so intensely accessible to anyone who goes there, and there's entertainment and there's information and it's great. I love that site. And then we have Queerly Beloved, and that's available for pre-order right now, so you can get it anywhere where fine books are sold and pick that up.
You could go to our website, queerlybelovedbook.com.
Perfect. queerlybelovedbook.com. Pretty exciting time for you, my friend.
It is indeed.
I have been reading your articles for so many years, and I have to tell you, I read that one on Pride Festivals years ago, and it's inspired me to have all sorts of conversations. So my hope is that you know that when you put your pen to paper or however you do it, you really are creating so many opportunities for all of us out there to dialogue, to have conversations about what's going on in the LGBT community, to just engage with others, and you're triggering that, and it's such a great thing.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you, darling.
All right. You keep doing what you're doing. Our thanks to Jacob for doing what he's doing, and we are looking forward to Queerly Beloved.
And my thanks to you as well. Take care.
Jacob's a fine boy, but his parents don't get along. They hardly talk when they do. Thinks he's done something wrong. He heard all the screaming as he lay down to bed. He should have been sleeping, but he listened instead. They say he's fine, it's not his fault. Between the lines, he somehow got caught. And in our game, it's more like war. I just don't think I love you anymore. He picked up the phone, his tears touched the receiver. His grandmother answered down in Tempe. He told her the story that his daddy was leaving. She tried to convince him it was nothing he'd done. She said, "You're fine, it's not your fault. Between the lines, you somehow got caught. And in their game, it sounds more like war. I just don't think she loves him anymore." Jacob's a father, and his kids are in teens. He's done what he could to make meager ends meet. When it comes down to family.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we actually have quite a bit of time left on this week's episode, so we can turn our attention to the latest LGBT news with some of my own views thrown into the mix. We will start with all the latest developments on marriage equality. A lawsuit that was just filed in federal court this past Monday argues that a North Carolina law banning same-sex couples from getting married violates the religious beliefs of clergy members and congregants who support marriage equality. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of a group of clergy members and same-sex couples, as well as the United Church of Christ. Let me repeat that. This lawsuit, which is arguing against the ban on same-sex marriage, was it filed by Lambda Legal? They might have supported it, of course. Was it filed by the HRC? I'm sure they supported it. But no, it was actually filed on behalf of a group of clergy members and same-sex couples, as well as the United Church of Christ. This is a huge development. This is a huge shift for the United Church of Christ and all these clergy members to really not just lend their support, but step out in front and say, no, no, no. Stop using us as an excuse for denying equal marriage rights to same-sex couples. This is not based in religion. We are putting our money where our mouth is and saying, no, no, we are fighting against this. So there's actually a great op-ed, as there always is, in the Huffington Post by our great buddy, the Reverend Emily C. Heath. So you can stroll on over to the HuffPost Gay Voices section and see her piece, but huge development of the clergy members really stepping up. So keeping our eyes on that. Then we stroll on over to, or up, I suppose, to South Dakota. Three same-sex couples are preparing to file a lawsuit challenging a South Dakota law that bars the state from recognizing same-sex marriages. The plaintiffs are expected to include a lesbian couple that married in Minnesota. It just feels like, I know this seems so cliche, and I also know that I've said it before on recent episodes, but the dominoes just keep falling and falling. I mean, South Dakota of all places. So Keeping our eyes now on South Dakota and seeing what's going to come up next. They're online interactive maps. You can easily find them. They're on a ton of different sites that are just tracking where there are lawsuits pending and where marriage equality has been achieved and where it's going to happen next. And so it's very exciting. Very exciting times. But I also just want to put out there, we have to remember marriage equality, not the only issue on our LGBT table. There's a lot of other stuff going on, and so let's turn our attention to some of that other stuff. Yes, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone. We know that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone, and apparently, based on the studies, since Don't Ask, Don't Tell was abolished, it has not impacted the military in any huge way, as some pundits thought that it would. But that is not to say that the military is a safe place or a welcoming place for our trans brothers and sisters. Landon Wilson, a transgender former communications specialist for the U.S. Navy, says he was discharged after his superiors learned he had transitioned to become a male. The Pentagon bars individuals who are in the process of transitioning from serving, a policy which is rooted in outdated medical research, according to experts. A set of human rights goals released by the Pentagon on Monday does not in any way address transgender service members. So again, yes, there are folks who believe, well, we solved the military thing, right? Didn't we just celebrate about that a few years ago? Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone. Yes, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone, but it's still not the place for trans folks to serve, particularly if they're transitioning. So more work to be done in the military. So this story, I'm going to tip my hand and ruin the ending of the story and say that it actually irks me. And I know that many are heralding the story and they're sharing it on Facebook and they're tweeting about it and saying, yay, look at what happened here. And I'm not into this story at all. But first, let me tell you what the story is. Neil Gottlieb, the founder and owner of San Rafael-based Three Twins Ice Cream, he planted a rainbow flag atop Uganda's highest peak last week to protest the East African country's recent passage of the Anti-Homosexuality Act, which calls for life imprisonment for many LGBT people and criminalizes the so-called promotion of homosexuality. Now, Gottlieb, he is a former Peace Corps volunteer and he's a graduate of Cornell. He published the photo of his prideful summit on Facebook last week and he shared a copy of the letter that he sent to the Ugandan president. And this is what he said in the letter, quote, "On April 16, 2014, after a six-day climb, I summited your country's tallest peak, Mount Stanley's 16,753-foot tall Margarita Peak, and mounted a gay pride flag at its summit in protest of your country's criminalization of homosexuality. Your country's highest point is no longer its soil, its snow, or its summit marker, but rather a gay pride flag waving brilliantly, shining down from above as a sign of protest and hope on behalf of the many thousands of Ugandans that you seek to repress and the many more that understand the hideous nature of your repressive legislation." So he called on the Ugandan president to consider the implications of the draconian law on his own loved ones. Were they LGBT? He went on to challenge the 69-year-old president, who has been in office since Uganda gained its independence in 1986, to summit the peak himself and remove the flag. And here's more of that language. He wrote, quote, Gottlieb wrote, quote, "If you don't like said flag on your highest peak, I urge you to climb up and take it down. However, you are an old man, and surely the six-day climb through the steep, muddy bogs and up the mountain's glaciers is well beyond your physical ability. Your days are more limited than most. Do you want your remaining days to be yet another blight on the history of your nation, or will you find the strength to reverse your actions and allow all Ugandans to be free?" So this is why I have a problem with it. Now, again, part of my background is that I've been to Uganda several times, and I would like to again remind folks that, yes, anti-gay law is terrible. It's terrible, and probably why I will never go back to Uganda, but it's part of a larger landscape in Uganda where right this second, so many folks don't have electricity and so many folks do not have running water. And HIV and AIDS is such a problem in Uganda right now. And education system is a total mess and the political system is completely corrupt. And so for the coverage of Uganda in the U.S. to be solely focused on this American who went to Uganda and climbed the highest peak and planted this gay pride flag and then used kind of obnoxious language to the president. I'm not in support of the president in no way, having spent time with some of the children in Uganda, a very small subsection of the children in Uganda who really did not like the president very much and feel that he is very corrupt, as is documented and is quite correct. But there's just no reason for this American to use the language in his letter that says, "You're old, and so you can't even climb the mountain where I, the healthy American, have climbed your mountain and planted the gay pride flag because this is the most important thing going on." I feel like I'm straddling the fence right here, and it comes across as if I'm in support of any of Uganda's laws barring homosexuality and criminalizing it, which of course I'm not. I love that country, and it really hurts me that they take such stances there in the government. But I also have been on the ground and know that this is not an important issue right now to some of the people who are dying. So I don't know. There's just something about this story that really irks me. I have had really kind of complex experiences with volunteering with American NGOs that swoop into Uganda and say, we need you to be more American, when in fact that's actually not what's culturally appropriate right now for Uganda. So I think I would feel differently about this story if this was about a Ugandan man or woman who had climbed the highest peak and planted the gay pride flag, which probably couldn't happen because their names would be published and they really would be sought out and probably murdered, as has happened in Uganda, unfortunately, more than once. But at the same time, there's just something that's really culturally dissonant about our celebrating this American ice cream store owner man who went to Uganda and wrote an obnoxious letter and planted this gay pride flag. I don't know. Not terribly coherent about that story. It just irks me, and it just feels culturally dissonant. But there it is. Moving on. San Diego, let's turn our attention, keeping our attention in California. San Diego's gay Republican city council member, have you heard about him? His name is Carl DeMeo. He can't figure out why the religious right, who he tacitly sides with on the culture wars, is more supportive of him than gay people whose civil rights he refuses to promote in office. He can't figure that out. He is now running from Congress. This was his latest quote. He said, quote, I found more tolerance, acceptance, and inclusion from social conservative groups who have to reconcile that I'm a Republican who happens to be gay versus the intolerance the LGBT leaders see me as a gay man who happens to be a Republican. This is what he's complaining about. This is what he's complaining about in the news. Now, we would like to remind him, as many articles have, the problem is not that he's a Republican. The problem is that he's a Republican who actively works to suppress the rights of his LGBT brothers and sisters. And this time, by the way, not just LGBT brothers and sisters, as I would say, of straight people, because we're all brothers and sisters, but his LGBT brothers and sisters, as in he is a part of that community. So he has said he would prefer to concentrate on fixing the federal government's finances instead of social causes, which, by the way, apparently are mutually exclusive, which, you know, they're not. So, yeah, it's kind of a little bit nutty that he, unsurprisingly, has not been supported by the Victory Fund, which supports gay Republican candidates. It's not like the Victory Fund doesn't support Republicans, but they actually do have rules there where they say, hey, you need to be somewhat supportive of LGBT rights, which DeMeo isn't. So DeMeo's incredulity as to why the LGBT community is not supportive of him, it's a little bit frightening for someone running from Congress. I'd rather you just say, you know what, I totally get why the gays don't like me because I don't support rights even for myself. I'm pretty self-loathing. But to say that he doesn't get it, that's really scary. Don't run for Congress because it seems like there's a lot that you don't get. So there's that. Over in Philadelphia, this is a really sad story. Giovanni's Room, which is believed to be the nation's oldest surviving bookstore catering to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, it will be closing next month. It opened in 1973. It's been in jeopardy for some time, but the owner, Ed Hermance, confirmed the news April 28th. The store will close on May 17th. Really, really sad. He said this, quote, the government is allowing Amazon to tighten their fingers around the throats of the publishers and drive their retail competitors out of the business by clearly monopolistic methods. So he has to close the store. He said, quote, it's a job of a lifetime, but I can't make it work anymore. The place needs new energy. Giovanni's Room has been open for 38 years, been losing money, but yeah, really quite the landmark there in Philadelphia. So very, very sad that that will be closing. New York's Oscar Wilde Bookshop, and we covered this on our show a few years ago, that one opened in 1967. It was previously the nation's oldest bookstore, but as we covered years ago, that closed in 2009. So LGBT bookstore is really hard to make. Maintain. And some articles out there say, you know what, it's not enough to be a bookstore these days. I used to work at Barnes & Noble. That's how I paid my way through NYU. So I loved working at bookstores back when you actually had to wear a tie to work there and they asked you questions about books. You actually had to know stuff, literary stuff. in order to work at Barnes & Noble. I don't know that that's the case anymore. I don't think that it is. I don't often see people wearing ties in there, but I had to wear a tie and know something about books. But in this market where you look at borders closing, yeah, it's not at all surprising that some of these LGBT bookshops cannot stay in business. So it's really important that they diversify and have events, and I'm sure that's what they were trying there. So it takes a lot of commitment to keep these things going. If you have an LGBT bookshop that's still open and still doing well, drop me an email. We'll have you on the show, ken@theshowisogay.com. A little bit of a college story for you. We do love the college stories. Cedarville University, which is a Baptist college here in Ohio, has had enough of their student publication, The Ventriloquist, so much so that this week, the university president and vice president for student life confiscated all 400 copies of the latest issue. So you're thinking, well, why is Ken covering this on This Show Is So Gay? Is it because he works at a college? Yes. Is it because it's a gay story? Yes, it also is a gay story. Some speculate that the recent op-ed by former campus community director Avery Reddick, who is gay and wrote about being removed from student government, the campus tour guide team, and a leadership position in the school's gospel choir after coming out, they say that might be the reason. Or maybe it's the sub-headlines like, quote, I'm gay, and quote, why I must live in fear at Cedarville. Headlines like that that are critical of the university. The publication staff seems just as puzzled as to why administrators are obsessed with preventing the latest issue from getting into students' hands. Ventriloquist editor Zach Snyder recalled Wednesday morning's events in an interview with Generation Progress, which funds the publication through their journalism network. Snyder said that copies were confiscated following a mandatory chapel service for all students, which is when the publication staff typically distribute new issues. University President Thomas White and Vice President for Student Life Jonathan Wood took copies from Schneider and his colleagues. And yeah, so they were, there was like an actual grabbing of copies. Schneider said, quote, I let him have the copies because I didn't want to get into a tug of war, but I asked if I could have the copies back. He just told me they were being confiscated. So as I've said on the show, I made the big transition from administration to the faculty last summer in moving here to Ohio. And I got to say, in so many areas, I'm reminded, oh, yeah, that's why I did this. This is one of those stories that reminds me, holy cow, do I not want to be an administrator anymore? Because why are you in the position, administrators, of taking your campus newspapers because they're critical of the administration? What the heck is the point of having a campus newspaper? If you're going to just achieve a campus newspaper in the way that you are achieving it there at Cedarville, then you might want to just have the administrators write the articles and save the students the trouble, and then you don't have to confiscate it. I don't miss administration. You're getting that? Don't miss it at all. A conservative organization in Maryland, a conservative group led by Republican member of Maryland's House of Delegates, announced this week their intention to overturn the state's recently passed Transgender Non-Discrimination Act through popular vote. The group's apparent chairman is the founder of MDPetitions.com, Republican delegate Neil Parrott. Late last month, the Maryland State Legislature passed the Fairness for All Marylanders Act, which we covered, a bill designed to extend public accommodation, employment, and housing protection to transgender individuals. MDPetitions.com urges visitors to, quote, sign this petition to send the bathroom bill, aka the Fairness for All Marylanders Act, to the ballot in November so that the people can decide. Have we still not learned the part where we're not supposed to put minority rights up for majority votes? How many times do we actually have to go through this? That's not something we learned in the 60s, because apparently it's not something we learned in the 60s in Maryland, where we're putting it out there that, yeah, this is all about bathrooms, and your kids might get molested in the bathrooms, which, by the way, that's how they're couching this story, the folks that are trying to get others to sign the petition, calling it the Bathroom Act. They're basically using fear tactics, because we still use fear tactics, apparently, to get people to sign petitions and put minority rights up for majority votes. So that is going on in Maryland. A lot else going on out there in the world, and some of it you need to look up on your own because we don't have time to cover all the stories, but go look up about the Boy Scout who he didn't mean to come out. He was outed on his own Facebook page. He put that he was in a relationship, and someone wrote, oh, who is he, excitedly, and then he was outed on his own Facebook page, and then the Boy Scout said, well, you can't serve anymore because you're technically an adult because he's 19. So the Boy Scouts basically have their own don't ask, don't tell policy, but if you're outed, even though you're kind of an Eagle Scout and you are the very model of a modern major Boy Scout, then I'm sorry, you can't serve anymore because being gay is incompatible. That Boy Scout thing is just nutty. And by the way, can we just remind everyone at every opportunity, the Girl Scouts, nothing like the Boy Scouts. They're so tolerant. So yay, Girl Scouts. Boy Scouts, come on, get with it. It's a little silly. So there's that story. Go look that up because it's a great read. You should also look up about the religious group that's doing the 40-day fast, and they feel that at the end of the 40-day fast, God will make it clear to them what they should do about same-sex marriage. And then people have been writing really mean emails to them saying, you know, I hope you starve to death, which that's not very nice. Let's not write that to them. Let them do their 40-day fast. Let them lose some weight, maybe lose some emotional weight, and then after 40 days they'll have some sort of revelation and think, okay, you know what, marriage equality, not so bad. We could live with marriage equality. So there's that 40-day fast. And then, the one other story that you must check out, that you must check out, it is called Look in the Mirror, Confronting the Contradictions of LGBT Organizations and Our, quote, Leadership. Okay, and it can be found on blackgirldangerous.org. Again, it's called Look in the Mirror, Confronting the Contradictions of LGBT Organizations and Our Leadership. It's a piece written by Christian Emmanuel Castang, and he is a queer Latino male. He was interning for an LGBT organization that he does not name. He is a political science senior at Grinnell College, and he details just really a horrible experience that he had working for this organization where he was harassed and he reported the harassment, and basically he writes this, quote, "The contradictions in our organizations and within any leader are vast. Keeping a movement that has turned its back on its least protected members demands that we reclaim the movement and hold it responsible. Our leadership cannot avoid being held responsible for unethical behavior, and we should not be afraid to hold them accountable. No, the revolution will not be televised, nor will corporations or war machines sponsor it. The organizations that claim to speak for you while avoiding accountability for their behavior will only use you." So he wrote this piece. You have to go check it out because I just read the end, but you have to read about his experience because he had quite the harrowing experience working as an intern for one of these LGBT organizations. And so, yeah, not good. Not good. And that is your all around the world news roundup. What an amazing show we have for you next week. We have Chadwick Moore is going to be on the show. He was on recently to talk about his past advocate pieces, and now he's going to talk about an upcoming advocate piece, including the June cover. So that's very exciting. A number of great guests coming up. But as always, if you have guest ideas, you should not hesitate to let me know. Any guest ideas whatsoever, just send me an email at ken@thisshowisogay.com and just give me ideas. Who's out there that you want on the show? We will reach out to them, and hey, we might even be able to get them. We have a pretty good track record. So Chadwick Moore is coming up on the show, many, many other amazing guests. Our thanks, of course, to Diane Anderson Minshall and all the amazing work that she's doing with HIV Plus magazine and her work over at The Advocate. Our thanks to you all for listening. We, of course, love that you listen and love even more when you send us an email. We love hearing from you and what you think. So, in the meantime, I urge you, please get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it. I don't know how to best use your voice. You do. Use your strengths and use it to raise up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you are out there in the world, whether you're writing an article, whether you are planting a flag atop a foreign country or maybe encouraging someone from that country to actually do it, no matter what you're doing to use your voice to make a difference, please, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? One boy, one boy, one boy, one boy, one boy, one boy, one special boy, one boy to go with, to talk with and walk with. One boy, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. One boy, one boy, one certain boy, one boy to laugh with, to joke with, have coke with. One boy, not two or three. Not two or three. Oh, one day you find out this is what life is all about. You need someone who is living just for you. One boy, one steady boy, one boy to be.
special guy. One guy to live for, to care for, be there for. One guy, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. One guy, one loving guy. One guy to look for each evening and cook for.